We're going to explore a couple of teachings in the Lojong practice. I know some of you are new. There are many ways to meditate in Buddhism. This is part of why I think many people feel an affinity for the Buddha Dharma, because we can really have a sense of what's going to be most helpful to us, right? What it is we need in order to feel better, right? To feel a sense of well-being. As we've been exploring throughout our meetings, it's very easy for us to feel a sense of dis-ease, a sense of frustration, right? The historical Buddha talked about how it can feel like there's a little thorn in our side, or that the arm is slightly out of its socket, right? We're very susceptible to feelings of frustration, right? Or a sense of chronic lack, something that we're needing that's always elusive. And so much of the teachings are about first just noticing that without any judgment, right? Because it really is part of the human condition to suffer. So in a way, the Buddha Dharma wants to normalize suffering and say it's okay, right? That there's nothing shameful about it. It doesn't mean that we're not getting things right if we're suffering. It means that we're human and that we come primed with these profound longings, right? For love, for affection, for a sense of freedom, right? For feelings of trust. But so often the conditions are always shifting, so that it's tough to really feel that we can count on that experience of love and well-being. And then the mind can start to cook up a scheme for how we're finally gonna get it. But that scheme, right, it has to happen, or else we won't. Yeah. So we've spent some time talking about what causes our suffering, right? The various ways we can get attached, right, to certain forms of well-being or pleasure. And the ways the mind can get stuck in anger and frustration, locked into a feeling of not quite getting what we're needing. But today we're going to shift our focus to having a look at whether or not we might actually be feeling better. Yes, it was a very optimistic perspective, right? And so the first of these three teachings is based on this pithy statement: all dharma has a single purpose. All dharma has a single purpose. Now, this is a way of helping the mind navigate what can feel like a rather ornate spiritual path, right? With lots of teachings and lots of concepts to contemplate. But this pithy teaching wants to remind us that really what we're looking at is why we so easily feel separate from others, right? What it is that gives rise to the feeling of isolation, of not being viscerally connected to others. Yeah. All dharma has a single purpose. And so dharma, popularly understood, is the teachings of the historical Buddha. But in this case, the dharma means knowable phenomena, right? That which we can know, that which we can know about. And from a Buddhist perspective, we can know if we're feeling disconnected, right? If we're not feeling a sense of being part of the same human family. And we can know why that is. Right? It doesn't actually have to be as mysterious as it often feels. Right? You might have noticed at times you feel a little bit alienated. You might be on the subway and not feeling like you're really connecting. Maybe other people are having experiences that all seem very similar to each other, but somehow different from your experience. Sometimes it's not so overt, right? Sometimes it's even more subtle than that. But in this Pithi teaching, the idea is that we can really work at cultivating a feeling of interbeing. Right? That our suffering can actually be a channel to be in intimate connection with others. Right? So rather than feeling that we're not getting something right, we're not figuring things out as others are, or we're burdened in ways that others are not. And the Dharma, the idea is that whatever it is we're experiencing can be a reminder, right, that this is our common ground. Yeah, this is our common ground. Both to struggle and to wish for happiness, right, to wish for a sense of peace of mind and fulfillment and well-being. And that when we really start to feel that sense that we are profoundly connected through this common experience, right, then normally what happens is we get very curious about others, right? All of the self-concern starts to soften. And then there's this awareness that, oh, I'm with all my friends, and I wonder what my friends are going through. Friends meaning everybody. Yeah. And so with this teaching, all Dharma has a single purpose. The idea is to check with oneself to see, is that self-concern starting to soften? It doesn't mean that we won't care about ourselves, of course. We need to, right? We need to stay healthy, and we need to do the various things that help us stay healthy in mind and in body, do the best we can. Or if we're sick, to care for ourselves with compassion. But just to notice, right, is the intensity of self-concern starting to soften so that there's more space in the mind for what others are experiencing. Does that make sense? Yeah. So this is a wonderful teaching just to check in, right, to see, okay, am I still really grasping at an experience that I wish for and remains elusive, so much so that there really isn't much room in my mind for others? Or am I starting to rest a little bit more inside myself so that I'm feeling freed up to notice what others might be going through, like might be thinking or feeling or wishing for? Right? So it's not about eliminating awareness of self or eliminating awareness of our personhood at all. Right? Our subjectivity matters. Our personhood really matters. But just to notice if the concern, right, the chronic nagging concern for ourselves starts to shift into perhaps a compassion, an awareness, but an awareness that holds much more than oneself. Yeah. All Dharma has a single purpose. All right. So building on that, all Dharma has a single purpose. The next one, and I really like this one, of the two judges, rely on the principal one. Of the two judges, rely on the principal one. I find this to be a fascinating teaching. And as you explore the teaching, you'll find commentary about how it's tempting to essentially let other people assess how we're doing, right? Let other people have the power to discern the nature of how we're evolving or not. And of course, there are some developmental underpinnings here, right? And in childhood, we seek to idealize others because we need to. We need to feel that there's some idealizable person in our environment. Even if they're really not living up to the idealization, there's that wish, right? There's a longing for some marvelous human being whom we're safely connected to. And I think this carries throughout the life cycle, right? It's a strong fantasy for someone else to have the wisdom, right, to be able to tell us how we're doing. This has something to do with why psychics are so marvelous, right? Because they're not thinking symbolically, they're not interpreting our experience, they're just telling us, this is how you're doing, and we love it. Finally, somebody can just tell me. I don't have to try to figure it out. Now, I poke fun, but only because I identify, right? We're relational. We need others, right? And sometimes we really need other people to clarify what might be murky for us, right? This is why we need friends. We need spiritual friends. We need mentors. Right, we need people whose perspective we can trust. Right. However, we must ultimately begin to cultivate trust of our own wisdom. Right, to really build a sense that only we can know. Right. Now, of course, this for most of us is a lifelong process. Right, of really viscerally feeling that we can trust our perspective. Yeah. Now, often it doesn't feel that way. It feels like we get clouded by strong feelings, which is true, right? Our feelings tend to be very, very powerful, sometimes quite flooding, so that they're stormy. Right, and if we're caught in a storm, it's hard to feel settled enough to dispassionately discern what's going on. Right, we're just in a survival mode. But the historical Buddha wanted to suggest that if we work with the mind and the heart to slowly, slowly start to feel more settled, right, to feel like we can arrive somewhere inside ourselves, then we can build that trust in our own wisdom, right? And so some scholars, including Nagarjuna, who is a great Buddhist scholar, and others said, well, still you might doubt if you can really trust your sense of how you're doing, whether or not you're developing and living into a sense of well-being, possibility. And he said, knowing what's inside another person is as hard as knowing what's inside a mango. I like that. We do our best with the mango, right? I mean, if you're like me, you really check it out. What are the signs that the interior are going to be delightful? Can you trust it, though? It's hard to say, right? We do our best. And then sometimes we're still very surprised by what we find. And so Nagarjuna, I don't think, was suggesting that we shouldn't build trustworthy relationships. Of course, we should do our very best, right, to try to assess and discern who are we finding to be basically trustworthy, right? The same way we do with a mango. We start to get a sense of the signs of a mango we're going to enjoy. But some part of the mind knows, right? We cannot be 100% certain, right? There's going to be some element of hiddenness. And so in this teaching, right, of the two judges rely on the principal one, the idea is to really start to build a reverence, right? Not a grandiosity, but a reverence for one's own wisdom. Yeah. I think this is a very powerful teaching, right? Because it's tempting always to doubt, right? Always to imagine that others, and of course we evoke certain mentors who seem surely trustworthy and surely wise, right? Whether it's His Holiness the Dalai Lama, or whomever, Pema Chodron, you can pick whomever inspires that feeling in you. That person, right, you can trust their wisdom. But my own, I'm so neurotic, I'm very anxious, right? I have weird dreams. I can't trust my own wisdom. But the historical Buddha wanted to suggest very strongly that we can. We can. We really just have to build relationship to that part of the mind that is clear seeing, that's receptive, right? That can take in reality, basically, an external and internal reality. And that can have a close look at what's actually there in our mind and our hearts. Yeah. And so I invite you, just in your practice, it can be interesting, even if you have a simple mindfulness practice where you're working with the breath, perhaps even just to use that pithy teaching as part of your practice, as an object of focus. Of the two judges, rely on the principal one. It can be interesting just to see what it stirs, right? When that comes into awareness as a possibility, right? That you could really trust yourself quite deeply, with discernment, right? With reflection. All right, now building on those two teachings, this third teaching, which I also like very much, is always have the support of a joyful mind. Always have the support of a joyful mind. This is also, I find, to be such a fascinating teaching, right? Because it, on the one hand, it gives rise to a sense of real possibility that we could have a joyful mind, right? Not just a frustrated mind, but that joy is an option. I mean, that sounds remarkable, right? But it can then also come with a little bit of self-criticism of why don't I feel more joyful, right? Why is there that easy default to a sense of frustration or anxiety? And in the commentary of this teaching, you find a lot of humanness, a lot of reassurances that, of course, we have fluctuations in feeling, right? Of course, we have experiences that stir all sorts of difficult feelings, right? Disappointment, sadness, confusion. Yeah. A lot of feelings, right, that just come into the mind and arise in the heart. And even those arisings don't negate or challenge our capacity to have a yet deeper joyful mind. And so this teaching is suggesting that if we're intentionally trying to cultivate that deeper layer of well-being, right, that sense of clarity, sense of spaciousness, that tends to generate a feeling of joy, right? That, hey, listen, anything is possible, right? The most unbelievable challenges can shift and become fodder for the most unbelievable sources of fulfillment, right? So that joyful mind, if we work on it, can become a kind of inner holding environment for all the other arisings of the mind. This, I think, is such good news, right? To put a Christian spin on it. It's really good news that we don't have to totally wipe out our irritation, our cynicism, whatever our quirks are, right? Our various emotional idiosyncrasies. That's okay. They can come and they can go. But that it really is possible to build that deeper realm of mind that is always there for us. Yeah. Now, I want to just note that the teaching can almost sound like an invitation to a little bit of spiritual bypassing. Right? I mean, what if you're going through something extraordinarily difficult? Right? Should you still always have a joyful mind? And I have a sense, I mean, my teacher and other teachers would say, yes, they're not mutually exclusive. Right? Which doesn't mean that you have to camouflage the challenging feelings. Doesn't mean you have to deny frustration, disappointment, anger, etc. It just means that this is not ultimately what defines you, right? That those various feelings are truly dynamic. They come and they go. It's the same with pleasure, right? Or excitement. Truly dynamic. And the stuff that seems inherently pleasurable can very easily become a source of pain and frustration, right? So all of these feelings are just like waves. But it really is possible to deeply build relationship to that foundational layer of mind, right? In the Lojong, it's referred to as a joyful mind. I might call it a clear mind. Right, or a spacious mind. And often when we're directly accessing a spacious mind, there is a sense of, you could call it joy, or you could call it basic well-being. Right? It's all right. Yeah. So, bless you. I'm going to pause in a few minutes to take some questions, but just as a recap, right? Bless you. As you're working with the Dharma, right, and as you're working with Lojong, you can think about what the Dharma is for, right? Sometimes this question comes up, is it so that we'll feel more compassionate? Is it so that we'll feel more patient? Is it so that we'll get enlightened? And if so, what does that mean? Does it mean that we'll never suffer again? There are lots of questions. If you're really getting interested in the Dharma, it's a very stimulating tradition, right? And you're going to be doing some textual study to fuel that curiosity. So just as a recap for these pithy teachings, right, we're first just noticing what this Dharma is for, right? This Dharma is for an effort to really see if it's possible to begin to deeply challenge feelings of fundamental separateness. Right. If I really had to sum up the proverbial 84,000 teachings, that's what I would emphasize. Right, because as we've talked about throughout our meetings, when we feel less separate, we tend to suffer less, even with the very same sources of suffering continuing. Right, when we feel less alone, when we feel that someone else, and then if you expand out from that someone to many others, know about your suffering, it can radically reduce it. And the same is true for your happiness, right? When you're going through something that feels enlivening, right? When it feels like it gives you joy. And then you imagine the other beings who might share in that joy. You almost offer it up to others. It proliferates it. Right? It becomes less of something that you have to worry about holding on to and more something that you can experience with your human family. Right? Yeah. And so as you're working on that long-term project, that long-term lifelong goal, spiritual goal, you can notice if you're also cultivating relationship to your own wisdom, right? Of the two judges, rely on the principal one. And are you starting to trust what you intuit about how you're doing? Right? Is there a feeling of internal relationship? Right? That doesn't, again, negate your need for trustworthy others, right? For people who might be a little farther along the psycho-spiritual path. But leaves you room, right, to bolster that internal relationship. Right? This is the relationship that's most needed. And it's often the last one that we work on, right? So very important, very meaningful, just to notice if you can rely on the principal judge, and hopefully a judge that's very compassionate, right, that's not mean-spirited, right, that can be patient and tolerant with what's found. Yeah. And then lastly, as you're discerning how you're doing, right, do you notice that you always have a joyful mind that you can access? Right? Do you always have a joyful part of yourself, right? Some chamber in the heart that's open to you, even in the midst of difficulties, right? Even in the midst of real challenges? Is there some gentleness that you can access on your own behalf? And certainly that you can access on the behalf of others.